Earth and Sky.
I think we have to recognise the dilemma. We'd all like to have everything done renewably, but it's going to take decades to get there. It doesn't happen overnight. In the meantime, we must start managing the CO2 emissions from those fossil fuel emitting power stations, refineries, steel plants and so on. And CCS is the only technology that allows us to do that. Hence the drive urgently to start rolling it out.
You're listening to John Barry of Shell International, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Barry is Shell's Vice President for Unconventionals and Enhanced Oil Recovery. He's speaking to us today about a different technology, carbon capture and storage, or CCS. Carbon capture and storage could lower global CO2 emissions by up to 20% by the year 2050, according to the International Energy Agency. Dr. Barry spoke more about carbon capture and storage with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. Barry, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. What's important for people to know about carbon capture and storage?
So it's good to think about it in three parts. The first part is the capture. And then there is a transport of captured CO2 to the third part, which is the storage. We transport it from a capture site to a storage site. When I talk about capture, I'm thinking about the science and technology that's needed to separate CO2 out from the gases coming out of a power station, for example, up the chimney, or emissions of CO2 from our refineries. Those are good examples. And to take the CO2 out of those gases and stop it being emitted to the atmosphere needs some quite clever chemistry, something we know how to do today, but I'm sure it can be done more efficiently when we start to do it on a bigger scale. Once we've captured the CO2, that's stage one, then we've got to transport it somewhere where it can be stored. That might be transport of a few miles, or it might be hundreds of miles. And we're lucky in a way that that part of the technology chain is already proven. We in Shell know that very well because we built a large CO2 pipeline in the western part of the United States in 1983. It's 500 miles long. It runs from southwest Colorado down to west Texas. And it's a big pipeline, 30 inches diameter, which has been operating ever since. It's actually not been done for CO2 sequestration. In those days, that wasn't really being discussed. It was done for the enhanced oil recovery industry. The CO2 is injected into oil reservoirs and drives more barrels out. But we know that we can transport CO2 long distances safely. That's element number two. And finally, the storage part, which I think to the general public is the most mysterious part because it involves something that can't be seen, the deep underground storage reservoirs. That's something which is beginning to be proven in places like Norway, where Statoil have been injecting CO2 into a reservoir near the Sleipner field for more than 10 years now, and the CO2 stays down there. We can monitor it and show that it's safely stored and is expected to stay down for the long term.
What do you think it would take for carbon capture and storage to scale up and become more widely used?
Well, the most important hurdle is probably policy, but let me just finish with technical first. So while all the bits of this chain from capture through transport to storage exist today and have been actually demonstrated on some small scale, it hasn't been done in a joined up way, in a fully integrated way attached to a big power plant, for example. So we need to scale it up. We need to learn how to make the technology cheaper above all. It's something that can be done today, but is relatively expensive, and it won't play its full role if we can't drive the costs down. And that's a target of many of the early projects which governments and industry are jointly funding. On the policy side, there are several things that need to be done. I've already talked about the need to bring the public along with us in deploying this technology. And I think governments, institutions like universities, national laboratories, NGO organisations can all play a really helpful role there, ensuring that the debate is held in a very transparent way, that independent scientists are thinking about how to monitor CO2 when it's underground, how to verify that what we think will happen is indeed happening. So I think a big role for policymakers to think about the regulations that will enable that. Secondly, they need to think about some changes to the legal framework. In many countries or states or provinces, We have a legal framework that makes it quite difficult to inject CO2 today. There are some countries close by here, for example, where CO2 has until very recently been defined as a waste product, and you're just not allowed to go and inject it, which is a bit ironic, really, that this rather positive solution for the climate has been prohibited on environmental grounds, just an unintended consequence of earlier laws. But perhaps the most important policy blocker at the moment is the third and final one, which is to do with the financing of CCS projects. In the longer term, I expect that the price that is put on CO2 emissions, and that's coming, if it's not already come to a country near you, it's about to happen. CO2 will be priced either through taxes or perhaps through cap and trade schemes. In the longer term, those prices will be enough to pay for CCS. By not emitting CO2, by storing it underground, a company won't have to buy CO2 emissions allowances, and that will be a good economic case to do CCS. But in the early days, before these pricing mechanisms were in place everywhere, and while CCS is still a relatively small scale and somewhat more expensive technology, it's going to need a bit of extra help to start making it happen. Some early deployment funding, you might call it. I think a really good example was an announcement which was made in October of 2009 by the Albertan and Canadian governments, where they agreed to support a project which Shell is leading in Alberta. We call it the Quest project. It's the storage of 1 million tonnes or so a year of CO2 near Edmonton. And they're funding it really quite significantly. They're going to put $865 million in, which is probably a little over half of the costs of that project. And I think a very good example of both industry and government putting money in, sharing the risk of doing these early projects, which will give huge learning and help us to drive down the costs in future.
World leaders will meet in Copenhagen in December of 2009 to decide what needs to be done about climate change. What goals should be set for the use of carbon capture and storage?
What the Copenhagen process needs to do is to see the OECD countries, the richer world, if we like, adopting hard commitments, quantified commitments on the reduction of CO2 over the years. This is already being done in a number of countries. We've seen the EU announcing, for example, it's going to have a 20% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2020, and a number of countries have adopted 2050 goals. Those are the kinds of targets that we need, and combined with market mechanisms for pricing the CO2 under cap and trade, that gives us all the drivers that we'll need in the longer term to encourage carbon capture and storage, greater penetration of renewables, more efficient vehicles, better use of energy in the home. All of the rest flows from that.
You've been listening to John Barry, Vice President for Unconventionals and Enhanced Oil Recovery for Shell International. Our thanks today to Shell, encouraging dialogue on the energy challenge. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.